In all likelihood, Sierra Leone has not been on your radar. The West African nation is one of the poorest. The over decade-long civil war that ended in 2002 was brutal. Nearly a third of the country's population was displaced, tens of thousands were killed, and more than 15,000 children were forced to fight as soldiers. How does a generation of young people recover from the mental anguish of that violence in a country that traditionally doesn't have mental health services? 31-year-old Suzanne Song is a psychiatrist who just finished her residency at Brigham and Women's Hospital here in Boston. She also works with the Research Program for Children and Global Adversity at Harvard's School of Public Health. They've been trying to develop a mental health system for child soldiers in Sierra Leone, and we want to learn about that today, and some of what we hear may be disturbing. Dr. Song, she joins us in the studio. You just returned from Sierra Leone. What are the lives of these former child soldiers like?
I want to expand the term to war-affected youth because there were not only child soldiers, but most everybody was affected by the war. So a lot of the adolescents are having difficulties with depression, with anxiety, with post-traumatic stress symptoms. And now with a breakdown in state structure, there's a lot of drug trafficking, and the drug abuse now is kind of rampant throughout.
So they're self-medicating.
That's right.
With illegal drugs. Well, I want to jump in to say that we spoke on this program recently about the Ugandan rebel leader, Joseph Kony. You're speaking of Sierra Leone. This is in Uganda. He kidnapped children and forced them to be child soldiers and often kept them in line by forcing cannibalism on them, forcing them to kill each other, kill the weakest in the group. You know, what were these kids? Let's start with the child soldiers. You know, what actually happened to them?
A lot of them, and they weren't only abducted into the rebel forces. Some of them had gone voluntarily because they thought they had no other choice. But many who were abducted were forced to go back into their villages and either maim or mutilate or amputate the limbs of family members, especially the gatherers, like the women of the family, so that they would not be allowed back into their family, so they would have nowhere else to go.
Wait, you're saying that they were forced to do this. I was thinking maybe there would be some sort of, you know, rite of passage that they had to complete, but you're saying it was to ensure that they would be outcasts.
Right. And so that they would not be able to go back to their family or that village, because now there's a stigma against them from the village.
You know, someone say, well, why did they do it? Why did they do what they were told?
For the ones that were abducted, they were taken by this rebel force and told, we will either kill you or we'll kill your family, or they were given promises. So we'll make sure your family is safe, we'll give you a car, we'll give you a home, we'll give you education. And now that's a large problem with the people who are working with former child soldiers in rehabilitation. They don't trust adults anymore. They're saying, I was in school, an adult came, took me out of school, made me use a gun, and how can I trust any of you adults now? And in addition, they say, I want the promises that you told me I would have. I want a family. I want a house. I want a car. So there's a lot of mistrust, which is then expressed as either behaviorally violent or aggressive or depression, anxiety.
When you say depression, anxiety, you know, they've become such catchphrases.
Right.
What do you mean? How does that exhibit itself in a kid in Sierra Leone?
A lot of kids will express more irritability and behavioral outbursts, difficulties with interpersonal relationships.
And we spoke of the child soldiers, but then there are the other children who might have been the sibling that the child soldier came back to maim, or the sibling that watched a family member be killed. You know, what are the issues for the other kids?
Right, so they're the actual perpetrators and then they're victims. And many of times, kids were both perpetrators and victims. The UN had come in around 1998 or so to start these what are called DDR programs, disarmament, demobilization, and rehabilitation. They basically had child soldiers come to them and give over their gun. Then they would go into the next step, which is demobilization, where they're put into different groups. And then they're put into rehab for skills, vocational training, either education or agriculture. Some of them were successful, but many of them were not. A lot of these DDR programs had left behind a lot of the children who were affected by war, not as actual soldiers, but there were a lot of, especially girls, who were porters or sex slaves or cooks who were still traveling with and working for the army or the rebel force.
Mm.
So because of this, there was kind of a backlash. So people had realized, oh, we're missing a lot of what are called bush girls. And so the international relief community had shifted towards gender-based violence programs to try to help integrate these other people who are not actually soldiers. The girl soldiers, or Bush girls, are experiencing a lot of difficulties right now. And, you know, a lot of people express anger at NGOs, non-governmental organizations, for giving these packages from the DDR programs to those who gave guns, but not to those who gave their wombs.
Wombs, because they were raped and they bore children to the rebels?
That's right.
Huh.
And that these girls only know abuse, and these Bush wives are not accepted back into their families because of the stigma of rape.
We're getting so used to hearing from Darfur on across that there are horror stories, but you heard horror stories. Is there one, I mean, you know, these are horrible, but it drives home what these kids are living with. Is there one you can share with us?
Yeah, I spoke to a woman who actually I was staying with, who had told me about a woman who was pregnant, and there were two rebel fighters staying on both sides of her. They were joking about and wondering whether or not the baby she was carrying was a boy or a girl. One would say a boy, the other would guess a girl, and then they slit her throat and then took out her baby just to see if it was a boy or a girl. They didn't really care, and they just disposed of the body.
Hmm. So this is the horrible disdain for human life that these kids are around. And as you said, they're suffering greatly, and you're trying to bring them mental health care. But what exists now in Sierra Leone? What platform do you start with there when it comes to mental health?
Their mental health system is very limited in that there is one psychiatrist for about 5 million people.
No, wait, one psychiatrist?
One psychiatrist for the country.
Is it the government psychiatrist? Is it known as the...
He does work for the government. His name is Dr. Naheem, and he's been the only psychiatrist for almost 20 years. Because Sierra Leone is so poor in current resources, they don't have many graduates from their medical school. And even if someone did want to go into psychiatry, there's not very good compensation. You have to go out of the country to be trained in psychiatry. And there's also the stigma of mental illness. So people view mental illness as being, you know, a psychotic person running naked through the streets. But they don't think about depression or the effects of war on their psyche.
Mm. If they do recognize the issue, how do they care for it? Obviously, they're not all going to be able to go to this one man. So how does the average person in Sierra Leone take care of mental problems? Where do they go?
Most people go to traditional healers, where they do things like rituals or body washings, or they go to the Evangelical Church, and they do prayers.
And you say this is one reason the Evangelical Church has grown, because people use prayer as mental health care. Well, coming up next, what happens now? We're going to have more with Dr. Suzanne Song. And later today is... I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're back with more of our conversation about Sierra Leone and the mental health issues facing thousands of children forced into violence by the country's civil war. We're talking with Dr. Suzanne Song. She's a psychiatrist working with a group at the Harvard School of Public Health that's trying to set up a mental health care system. So, Dr. Song, how will you do that? What's the goal of your group?
The goal of the group is to increase services for war-affected youth. I'm the clinician for the group, and as such, I'm very much interested in culturally appropriate ways of treating kids there, using their own vernacular about what kind of symptoms do they have. So, for example, a couple of the kids have talked about terms called faux straight or toment.
Faux straight torment.
Mm-hmm. Which are different expressions of depression and anxiety.
Oh, maybe that's frustrate and torment.
It could be similar,
yeah,
too.
Yeah. And so those are their words,
right,
for how they feel.
Mm-hmm.
And so you want to set up a program that speaks to them in their own language. And that brings to mind, here you are coming in filled with goodwill, but you're an American. Is there resentment? I mean, some people might say the problem is we need food, we need homes, and we certainly don't need someone from America coming to tell us about our heads.
Mm-hmm.
Have you had that?
Very much so. When you go to Sierra Leone, there are a lot of abandoned buildings where NGOs used to be. And the community does have some distrust of international organizations who come in, and sometimes they spend 1 month or 6 months. A lot of localers think that most of the funding goes to the administrative costs of the NGO and not actually to the Sierra Leonean people.
So they think that these NGOs are just people who are siphoning off aid instead of delivering it, which isn't, more than likely isn't true, but that's their perception?
To some extent. And some people do say that they're doing good work, but then they're gone. So, for example, one person had told me right after the war, NGOs had come in, they had trained local people to be mental health counselors. So they had 1 day training in how to be a mental health counselor.
Hmm.
Then they sent these people out into the villages and provinces where they would stir up trauma histories in these kids, but then not know what to do with it. So it'd kind of be like me doing a one-day training on cardiac surgery, opening up somebody, messing around in there, and then trying to shove it all back together.
Or walking away and just leaving it open.
Right.
So it sounds as if you're part of a movement to build something sustainable in Sierra Leone, but you've already said one-day training doesn't work. The teaching hospitals aren't producing doctors, so how do you do that? How do you change the infrastructure?
The goals are, yes, one is sustainability. And with that, you need to have buy-in from the government. Also, to try to foster local Sierra Leoneans to develop their resources and to support their ideas. We don't want to foster dependence on international relief organizations. And one of the general practitioners I had met had said, "We Sierra Leoneans need to help ourselves. You can support us."
Well, let's pick up on some of those things. Has the government been helpful?
The government, I think, is very overwhelmed right now. Sierra Leone is the poorest country in the world. It has the highest infant mortality rates, and now HIV/AIDS is becoming a problem. So mental health right now is not a priority just because they have so many other problems.
And why should it be? In addition to, you know, making life better for these young children in particular, why should it jump the line?
Poor mental health can affect the labor force. It can affect, you know, economic infrastructure, quality of life, interpersonal relationships, and just the rebuilding of society in general.
So how do you start changing it?
What we're trying to do is we'll go back in hopefully around December or January. We are inviting people from the ministries of health, of the Sierra Leonean government, members of the WHO, as well as local community members like paramount chiefs of each village, traditional healers, to, one, disseminate information, to say, you know, we've done this longitudinal study of former child soldiers. These are our findings. These are what we see. And so it kind of brings everybody together to the same table, and then we can all kind of discuss what resources do you have, what do you need help with, and how can we start to build a mental health system here.
Hmm. Do you mind my asking a personal question? First of all, I should disclose, you happen to be a neighbor of mine, and you were getting out of the cab one day the other day. I said, "Oh, how are you? Where you been?" "Oh, Sierra Leone, where I'm trying to set up mental health facilities." Got my attention right away. You've chosen to work in the area of mental health, but this is pretty tough stuff, the child soldier aspect. What's it like for you to see this?
You know, when I came home from Sierra Leone, the first thing I did out of the airport was come home, and I cried.
Yeah.
I came to my room, and I cried for a couple of hours. I cried for the developmental delay that was enforced on these kids. I cried for the adults who had violently lost their loved ones, for the general poverty of the country. But I think I also cried just in wonderment of the people of Sierra Leone. They are a very strong group of people. The resiliencies of these kids is just unbelievable. And, you know, the strong women of Sierra Leone who carry tons of weight on their heads as well as a baby on their back, and I feel like they very much carry a lot of the families and the extended support network of Sierra Leone.
You're obviously still touched now by this, yeah.
I am. You know, everybody knows somebody who's been affected by the war. I remember once I had a soda once sitting in a restaurant with somebody, a local diamond miner in Kono, who had talked about how his family, his father, mother, brothers and sisters were trying to flee from Kono, which is on the eastern part of the country, to Freetown on the western part. And his family was stopped by rebel forces and killed. The entire family killed, and he was the only one that survived. But his story is everywhere, and listening to that just makes your heart sink. And for me, it makes me want to learn more about it. And I think especially a lot of Westerners or international groups that go into Sierra Leone, the thought from Sierra Leoneans is that, oh, here's another Western person coming, and they think that they know everything, or they don't even ask us what our needs are. They just kind of come with their money and do what they want. And I'd like to not use that approach.
That's Dr. Suzanne Song. She's just finishing her residency at the Brigham and Women's Hospital here in Boston, Massachusetts. She's about to go to Stanford to continue her studies in child psychiatry. She's also a member of the Research Program for Children and Global Adversity at the Harvard School of Public Health. Suzanne, thanks for coming to talk to us.